If Putin likes Donald Trump, guess what, folks? That's called an asset, not a liability. Now, I don't know that I'm going to get along with Vladimir Putin. I hope I do, but there's a good chance I won't. And if I don't, do you honestly believe that Hillary would be tougher on Putin than me? Does anybody in this room really believe that? Give me a break.
President-elect Donald Trump giving his first press conference in 6 months. During the often combative hour and change, Trump answered questions about Russia, how he'll divest from his business interests, Obamacare, and about the story that's grabbing all the headlines right now, a dossier floating around Washington that alleges the Russians have dirt on Trump and are blackmailing him with it. Joining us now to talk about Trump's press conference, the dossier, and more are Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Van Newkirk, politics reporter for The Atlantic. Hello.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And Drew Harwell, business reporter for The Washington Post. Welcome to you.
Hey, thank you.
Michael, let's begin with the dossier. Here's what Donald Trump said during the presser today.
It's all fake news. It's phony stuff. It didn't happen. And it was gotten by opponents of ours, as you know, because you reported it, and so did many of the other people. It was a group of opponents that got together, sick people, and they put that crap together.
Okay, Michael, give us the background on this. Where did it come from? Who has seen it? And how much of it has been substantiated, if any?
Well, I would say for openers, it's important to understand that none of it has been substantiated, possibly a couple of small details or a few small details in a 35-page report, but it includes a lot of pretty explosive allegations, including some very salacious ones that have not been substantiated. And this, despite the fact, and I guess to back up, what we're talking about is a 35-page report written by, it has been reported this afternoon, a former British intelligence operative who now does sort of corporate private research, who was hired by Trump opponents. I think initially his firm was hired by Republicans and then by Democrats to look into Trump's relationship with Russia. And this guy came up with 35 pages, actually I think several reports going back to the spring and through the campaign, where he claims to have sort of murkily identified sources. Some are in the Kremlin, there's one in the Russian Foreign Ministry, there's some people in Trump's orbit who lay out all these allegations that, you know, much of which is consistent with the intelligence that has been disclosed to the public about Russian sort of coordinated, Putin-directed Russian attempt to interfere in the U.S. election. But it goes further, making more sensational charges, including ones that suggest that Trump, you know, was compromised or, you know, his intermediaries were acting in concert with the Russians, which would take all of the, you know, charges we have now to a much more explosive level. So this 35-page report has been circulating around, and dozens of journalists and sort of political people in Washington have been aware of it for a while. Not everybody had a copy, but sort of word of mouth was running rampant. And many news organizations, including reporters at Politico, made efforts to verify the claims in this report, and so far have been unsuccessful. And to wrap it up, what happened was it appears that in the intelligence briefing on the Russian hack of the election that was presented to Trump on Friday by senior U.S. intelligence officials who detailed what they believe was this coordinated Kremlin campaign to influence the election, hack emails, propagate fake news stories, it included an appendix that referred to this report, did not include the report itself, and if I understand correctly, essentially said, you should be aware that these allegations are circulating widely out there. This is basically what it says about you, and we consider it part of our duty to just make sure that you know it's out there. And the last piece of the puzzle here is that after CNN reported that that appendix existed without getting into the details, maybe 90 minutes later or so last night, BuzzFeed, which had a copy of all 35 pages of this former British intelligence guy's private intelligence report, just published it online for the world to see, and you see what Trump's reaction is. He's saying it's fake news, mm-hmm. and denouncing all kinds of people.
So the fact that these intelligence chiefs appended this 2-page summary of this 35-page report and gave that to Trump and also Obama, that doesn't mean that they endorse its veracity, right, or that they take it seriously. It's just that they were just saying, look, it's out there. You should be aware of it.
Right. I mean, I think I can't prove this, but I don't think that they would have mentioned it. Look, if this hadn't passed the laugh test, you know, if this was something on a crazy conspiracy theory website, they're not going to mention it. The intelligence officials have been telling reporters that they consider the author of the report to be a credible guy. And I think that's probably why it cleared the bar for them to mention it, as opposed to, you know, they're not going to mention every wild conspiracy theory out there that doesn't, as I say, pass the laugh test. So I think there's, you know, a measure of, it's not an endorsement and it doesn't say anything about the specific charges, but I think that you can't say it doesn't say anything about how they view this report. They view the author as credible, and they seem to think Trump should know about it as a result, although on the specific charges, and there are many, it's true the Intelligence Committee, the community, is not saying that they believe they're accurate or that they have been able to authenticate them.
Okay, so that provoked the ire of Donald Trump, as you say, and he singled out not only BuzzFeed, castigated BuzzFeed for publishing the entire dossier, but also CNN. And I just want to play an exchange between Trump and CNN's Jim Acosta at the news conference today.
Go ahead.
President-elect,
go ahead.
Since you are attacking our news organization, can you give us a chance?
Your organization.
You are attacking our news organization.
Your organization.
Can you give us a chance
Let's
to
go.
Ask a question, sir?
Go ahead.
Sir, can
Quiet.
You state, can,
Quiet.
Mr. President-elect,
go ahead.
Can you state categorically?
She's asking a question. Don't
Mr. President-elect, can you give us a question?
Don't be rude.
You're attacking us. Can you give us a question?
Don't be rude.
Can you
no,
give
I'm
us a question?
I'm not going to give you a question.
Can you state categorically?
You are fake news.
Sir.
Okay, he's calling CNN fake news there. Van Newkirk. He successfully criticized the news media during the campaign. There's, you know, the testy exchanges we just heard. Is this a continuation of this kind of fractious relationship between the media and Donald Trump, or are we going to see something different once he is sworn in?
I think what you see is what you get right now. Also, during the press conference, he attacked BuzzFeed, called them garbage or something to that effect. And this is, you know, this is what Trump does. I think even the whole concept of a presser of some sort of open forum with journalists seems to be more of a spectacle than an effective way to release information and field questions from journalists. This seems like, you know, almost gladiator games at this point. You have people come, it's very sensational. We had multiple people speak and weren't really clear on what the topic was going to be. I think if Trump were looking to turn over a new leaf and try really being transparent and using press conferences as a tool for information, then you'd do a lot better to control them, have them more frequently, be open to questions from adversarial outlets, and really make moves to be more effective at conveying information.
Right. And just to note that CNN did not publish the dossier or the details in it.
Right.
So, although that was conflated initially, CNN and BuzzFeed, I think, by Sean Spicer. So he also turned over the press conference to a lawyer, Sherry Dillon, to explain how he is going to handle ethics questions and how he's going to divest his various businesses. And here's a clip from what she said.
If President-elect Trump sold his brand, he would be entitled to royalties for the use of it. And this would result in the trust retaining an interest in the brand without the ability to assure that it does not exploit the office of the presidency. Further, whatever price was paid would be subject to criticism and scrutiny.
Drew Harwell, you've been covering Trump's business ties. What is he going to do to actually separate himself from his business? He has said, and he said legally, that the president cannot have a conflict of interest.
Yeah, he said the president can't have a conflict of interest, which is not exactly right. It's sort of classic Trump in that there is no sort of conflict of interest law that pertains to the president. It doesn't say you have to put all your stuff into a blind trust or sell it all off. But, you know, the concept of a conflict of interest is still very real. The president still has to abide by bribery laws. What he said today was that he would sort of shunt management of the company over to his kids and executives, that he would sort of put it in a trust and sort of impose barriers on himself so he doesn't know the what's going on in the company. He can't sort of make decisions outright. But what he didn't do is barrier off actual ownership of the companies. He still has the financial stake and that financial incentive to maybe want the company to do it as well as it could do. And, you know, when he ends his presidency in 4 or 8 years, he could potentially go back to owning the company and you know, reap the rewards of how the company has grown during his time in office. He will still likely gain money, get payments from the trust that the company will be in. So, you know, it's effectively, I mean, some ethics advisors, no ethics advisors are really partying in the streets over this. They sort of see this as almost a shell game, and that he kind of moved the paper into a different category, but the financial ties between, you know, Trump, the private businessman with a lot of money, and Trump, the public servant, that those ties are really still strong.
Well, his lawyer said that it would be impossible to do that because so much of it is about the branding and the royalties he would get from the name Trump. So even if he sold off all his businesses and put them in a trust, the name, he would still get money from the branding. And
yeah.
Is it possible to get around that? Could he just say, okay, I'm not going to accept the royalties?
Yeah, I mean, advisors say there are plenty of ways to get around it. The main way is that he could potentially sell the company to his kids. They're Trumps, right? I mean, they would still have the brand. Why he maybe doesn't want to do that is he would have to pay a very, very sizable gift tax in giving that to his kids. And they sort of brought that up today where they said, you know, the kids might have to take out a big loan to buy the company from dad. It's not a appetizing choice, but it's also the only real way to sort of barrier off these really, really big conflicts, these big entanglements that are still going to be there when he takes office next week and still going to be there through those 4 years.
Well, speaking of entanglements, Michael Crowley, he said during the presser that he has absolutely no ties to Russia that would need to be severed. Is that true?
Well, we have to take his word for that. And I think it's fair and objective to say that taking Donald Trump's word for something has not always borne out to be a good strategy. So I don't assume that that is the case. And as a political matter, at a minimum, and I guess a journalistic one, this underscores why people are calling for him to release his tax returns. Now, Trump said today that you don't learn much from a tax return, and was dismissive of the value of doing so, but it doesn't seem like that's something for him to judge. And I think the upshot of this kind of mounting pile of questions and charges about his relationship to Russia is just going to fuel calls from the media and members of Congress for him to release his tax returns or disclose a lot more about his finances than he has to show whether he does have investments in Russia or perhaps debts to Russia and Russians. But not a lot of evidence that he's going to be willing to do that.
Okay, let's turn to some domestic policy. He was asked about Obamacare and what he plans to do about it, and here he is.
We're going to be submitting, as soon as our secretary is approved, almost simultaneously, shortly thereafter, a plan. It'll be repeal and replace. It will be essentially simultaneously.
Van Newkirk, did he say what he's going to replace it with?
Oh, not at all. But I think the acknowledgement that they will be pursuing the plan after Price is potentially confirmed as Secretary of Health and Human Services is probably an indication that they're going to look at something similar to his own plan, which was the most developed among the different congressional Republican plans. And that's pretty standard Republican style plan. We got HSAs, tax credits for people who purchase insurance, and a cut of the Obamacare Medicaid expansion and tax subsidies for people who have low incomes. And the fact that the reconciliation process will probably begin tonight or tomorrow night on a potential repeal indicates that might be the case, since reconciliation can really only touch the funding parts of the bill, and Medicaid expansion and the subsidies are the biggest funding parts.
He also talked about the wall, and he was asked about who's going to pay for it, and he said, once again, Mexico's going to pay for it. How is that going to work?
Nobody knows yet. I think the biggest the thing that he's signaled so far is that it will essentially be a taxpayer effort, and that Mexico will, I guess, reimburse. That he has not detailed really at all how that process would work. It seems that at least up front, it would be funded by America.
All right, final question. I would like you all to weigh in on what we all gleaned from today's presser, the tone, what we need to prepare for in the next 4 years. And Van, let's begin with you.
So I think this press conference is probably a good example of what we can expect Trump's relationship with the press to be like over the next 4 years. I think what we're probably going to see is fewer press conferences, but by there being fewer press conferences, they'll be much more contentious, louder, spectacle-type deals.
Drew?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that he has a contentious relationship with the media and, you know, other representatives of the people who he serves is probably no surprise. But you could tell from the sort of shouting matches that they had today that that's going to be something we're probably going to be seeing a lot more of these next 4 years.
And Michael?
Well, he is just not backing down when it comes to Russia. He's making no apologies. He's continues to avoid saying anything negative about Vladimir Putin or to condemn Putin's behavior in any way. It continues to be very unusual, and I think we're still looking for a clear explanation of why that is, and we may never get one.
Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico, Drew Harwell, business reporter for The Washington Post, and Van Newkirk, politics reporter for The Atlantic. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And we want to hear from you. Were you watching the news conference? Was there a question you wanted reporters to ask and they didn't? What did you think about the overall tone? You can tweet us at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, politicians here in L.A. get a lot of money from developers who want smooth sailing for projects under construction in the city. Well, now some members of the city council want to ban developer contributions. We'll find out more about that next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. L.A. is experiencing a housing affordability crisis, and it's leading some to question whether real estate developers have too much sway at City Hall. Five city council members are now calling for a ban on political donations from developers with projects pending or recently approved by the city. This proposal did not come in a vacuum, of course. In March, Mayor Eric Garcetti and seven city council members are up for re-election. Some of their challengers have been playing up complaints about big new apartment projects around the city. There's also a measure on the ballot that would halt many large developments. David Zanheiser covers City Hall for the LA Times, and he joins me now. Hi.
Hello.
Well, who's calling for this new law, and what exactly would it do?
Well, there are five council members who proposed this yesterday, and it's still a little bit unclear because it's got a lot of steps. But basically what they said was they want to find a way to prohibit contributions from developers to candidates and elected officials at City Hall. It would also probably apply to what they call office holder accounts, which is kind of like a little fund of money. They can raise money from people and then use it to spend it on different things, travel, meals, that kind of thing. And that's going to take a while to really be vetted because the council has to decide they actually want to move forward with this, and then they're going to have the city's ethics commission try and come up with the particulars.
But they're not saying no donations ever from developers, so couldn't they just donate at another time?
Well, I mean, part of it has to do with restricting the donations when a project is being considered. There's something that already exists for contractors, which is to say companies that want to get city contracts. There were voters approved a ban in 2011 that limited companies and individuals who are seeking business from the city from contributing during that period. And so they're looking at trying to do something with a similar time frame here. Now, they won't be able to have it apply to everything. They've already said that, for example, the ban would probably not apply to what they call behested contributions. Those are not campaign contributions, but those are situations where a politician says, hey, donor, we'd love it if you'd give to this charity or this nonprofit or this initiative. The mayor does this quite frequently, Mayor Eric Garcetti. He will report that he has behested contributions, for example, to the city's effort to get the Olympic Games in L.A. in 2024.
So that would still be allowed?
That would still be allowed. Very likely also ballot measure committees would still be allowed, and those can accept unlimited amounts of money. And so we have already seen in many instances real estate developers and many other kinds of interests who give five- and six-figure contributions to those committees to support causes that are backed by the politicians at City Hall.
Well, speaking of ballot measures, Measure S, known as the Neighborhood Integrity Initiative, is on the ballot in March, and that would halt large developments that need special variances from the city for 2 years or so. Is this connected to that, do you think?
I think it's definitely part of the backdrop for this whole thing. I mean, they've been banging the drum for months about the issue of campaign contributions from developers and folks who are related developers. I mean, developers, for example, can bring in, you know, their architects or their engineers or any number of other donors to donate with them. They definitely have argued, I think, that they view it as a pay-to-play system. The politicians at City Hall say that that's not true. They say, at least some of the politicians I've talked to, I haven't talked to everybody, but they generally, when I speak to them on this topic, say that that perception is inaccurate. But at this point, there's a measure, there are council races, there's a mayor's race, and some of them are saying that even if there is an inaccurate perception, that this proposal would combat that inaccurate perception.
Well, how much reality is there to that perception, that developers, you know, do have an inordinate say in what happens at City Hall and what gets built if they donate?
Well, it's really, I mean, it's a harder question to answer than it might sound. I mean, you know, I've spoken to business leaders and they say, you know, developers give because they want the city to support, they want to support politicians who accomplish good things, get things done. They want to support causes that improve the city. For example, you know, I wrote last month about the real estate developer, Rick Caruso. Rick Caruso wants to build a 20-story building near the Beverly Center on a piece of property that's zoned for just buildings of just 45 feet. You know, he and his associates have given more than $476,000 to LA politicians and their causes over 5 years. When I talked to him, he said, hey, this is just part of my charitable giving. I want to support causes that are important to me. I want to support people who back those causes. He definitely argued against the idea that he has any more influence as a result of that money. On the flip side, the people who oppose his project say that that money puts them at a political and tactical disadvantage, and it gives him more clout than they do. And they were very alarmed that, you know, six-figure contributions were going from Caruso to, for example, Garcetti's transportation tax campaign in November. You know, he supported a half-cent sales tax increase mm-hmm. to support
public transit. Ricruzzo provided $200,000 to that measure. You know, Garcetti picks the Planning Commission, which reviewed Caruso's project and endorsed it in November. All these things are alarming to the people who oppose it. Caruso says, no, you know, I support people and causes when I think it's going to improve the city, and these donations are no different from the donations to anybody else, churches, nonprofits, et cetera.
It's interesting that one of the councilmen who is up for re-election and is behind this, Joe Boscaino, you reported that he had received donations from a developer on a project in his district called the Seabreeze, which was riddled with ethical problems.
Well, we did a story back in October about the Seabreeze project, and what we found was that Joe Buscaino, who represents the area where Seabreeze was proposed, he had received, well, we identified at least $94,000 in donations to him. He, like all the other politicians we talked to for that story, said donations had no influence on his decision, but when he signed this yesterday, he said that he wants to combat the perception. He doesn't want people to think there's any other motive other than his desire to build housing when he approves housing projects. You know, that story was a different kind of story from the one we wrote about the Caruso project, in that, you know, not only did we identify a vast web of contributors who were linked both directly and indirectly to the developer of the Seabreeze project, but my colleague, Emily Alpert Reyes, and I, we knocked on doors and talked to some donors who either denied giving or said they didn't remember giving. So that was a whole other kettle of fish, because now you have people saying that they don't remember their donations, and that raises the prospect that they weren't the true source at all, which, by the way, would violate the law.
Right, right. Well, is there a simple fix to this? I mean, is it just having publicly funded elections?
I would like to say it's like the Middle East. you know, it's really hard because, you know, people always say money flows like water, you know, what finds its source, and that definitely is one of the things that could happen in this scenario. You know, we spoke to somebody yesterday who said if this money is really barred to campaigns of council members and the mayor and their office holder account, that you're going to see more money flow into what they call independent expenditure committees, which is campaign committees that by law have no limits on the size of contributions they can accept. And one of the political consultants I spoke to yesterday said he's worried that not only would the money become much, much bigger, but that it would be much less accountable because it would be going through a third party who by law could not be involved with the candidates that they support. As they support them in the campaign.
All right. David Zanheiser covers City Hall for the LA Times. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
And we want to hear from you when it comes to real estate in your neighborhood. What would you like to see? Are there too many big apartment projects being built? Not enough? What do you think of developer influence at City Hall? Let us know your thoughts in a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or on Facebook at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, my conversation with Janelle Monáe. She's in two movies out right now that feature largely unknown stories about African Americans.
I was excited, then I became upset, then I became confused. Why hadn't I heard about these women? I'm an African American woman.
Janelle Monáe, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Six-time Grammy nominee Janelle Monáe is known for high-energy, electrifying pop and R&B music.
Ooh, just shove it, shake it, baby. Electric lady, you're a star. You got a classic kind of crazy. But you know.
That's Electric Lady from her second album of the same name. Her songs often tell stories of bold, unapologetic women in a distant future. She's called herself a time traveler, a businesswoman, and of course, an artist. Well, Janelle Monáe recently ventured to a new frontier, the big screen. She made her film debut in the hit drama Moonlight, and now she plays a pioneering NASA engineer in Hidden Figures. Based on a true story, the film follows three Black women who were instrumental in launching the first American into space. Janelle Monáe joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you so
Big
much.
Year for you on
it's
the screen.
Exciting.
I know.
It's so exciting.
Really exciting. So tell me about getting the script for Hidden Figures. And when you read it, what did you think?
So when I read the script, I was excited. I thought it was historical fiction. I thought it was a fictitious story. And I said, wow, someone has finally written the characters I want to see portrayed on screen. Finally, we're going to have three female protagonists who are going to be beautiful and brilliant, and they're going to be celebrated for their brilliance. People will know about them. And then I discovered that these women did exist. They were real. And so I went through a lot of emotions. I was excited, then I became upset, then I became confused. Why hadn't I heard about these women? I'm an African-American woman. You know, I'd never heard about them in my history or math classes or, you know, I had no clue. And I was like, man, was I paying attention or not? And then I talked to people, my family and friends, and nobody had heard of these women. So then it became a personal responsibility to make sure that no other young girl, no other American went through life not knowing about these true American heroes. These were the women who helped get our first American astronauts into space.
I know. It's amazing that we haven't heard this story when we've heard so much about the space program. And
yeah,
so
I
much
mean,
about
you look at documentaries.
Astronauts.
We know about, you know, the Apollo 13. We mm-hmm. know, of course, about John Glenn, God rest his spirit. But we don't see any women in these documentaries. We don't see any of the women who did the math. Before there were computers, before there was an IBM, we were the women, Black, white, Hispanic, you name it. We were doing all of the math and doing the projections to help get them on the moon and to help John Glenn orbit the Earth.
And your character, she wants to be an engineer.
I play the first African-American female aerospace engineer.
But there's a struggle in the movie where
oh, yeah.
she's not allowed to take classes at the college. And
absolutely. So this also takes place during the Cold War. And it takes place during the segregation era. And African-American women didn't even have the right to vote. We did not have a say in our democracy. They didn't have the agency that, you know, both of us have today. And so she, because of the color of her skin and because she was a woman, could not attend advanced courses at this all-white high school without petitioning the courts. And she did just that.
Let's hear you as Mary Jackson petitioning the judge in your case.
No Negro woman in the state of Virginia has ever attended an all-white high school. It's unheard of.
Yeah, unheard of.
And before Alan Shepard sat on top of a rocket, no other American had ever touched space. And now he will forever be remembered as the U.S. Navy man from New Hampshire, the first to touch the stars. And I, sir, I plan on being an engineer at NASA. But I can't do that without taking them classes at that all-white high school. And I can't change the color of my skin. So I have no choice but to be the first, which I can't do without you, sir. Your Honor, out of all the cases you're gonna hear today, which one is gonna matter 100 years from now? Which one is gonna make you the first?
So that's quite a speech.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, did she actually say that? And did that actually happen? Or is this there's some dramatic license taken?
One thing we do know is that Mary Jackson absolutely did petition the court. And one thing we do know is that she had to study her enemy. She had to figure out how she was going to get this man in this city, this state that did not even believe in Jim Crow. They were their own planet. And how is she going to get him to empathize with her? And one of the things that she found in doing research on this judge was that he was the first in his family to do a lot of things. And so they connected over that.
Mm.
And it just took him back. And I think they were able to have this human-to-human connection. They put race aside, and he was able to see her as someone who was just like himself.
And he granted her petition.
And he granted her the petition. Mm. And she became the first African-American female aerospace engineer at NASA.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Janelle Monáe. She stars in the new movie Hidden Figures. You are also in Moonlight.
Yes.
That's just a great movie. I interviewed Barry Jenkins recently about it and just blew me away. totally different character. You play kind of a mother figure to Chiron, the lead character. Talk about that character and what you wanted to bring to it.
Well, both Mary Jackson and Teresa, who I play in Moonlight, are both strong, powerful, dynamic, heroic women. Mary was that for NASA and her community during that era. Teresa was that for her community. She was the light in such a dark neighborhood. Mm-hmm. She wanted to protect Chiron. She was a surrogate mother to him because his mother could not be there for him emotionally because of her substance abuse problem. I think that what was so important about both these characters, and we're speaking about Teresa from Moonlight, was that they were seen as complete human beings. I pulled from a lot of people in my community, a lot of women who were married to drug dealers, but they were also pulling out the best in these men who, despite their circumstances and their mistakes, still wanted to grow, and they needed that type of energy around them. And so her job was just to protect Chiron and make sure that he did not become another statistic, someone who was going to end up in jail because of selling drugs, or someone who was going to be murdered or killed, like Juan, her husband, mm-hmm. for selling drugs and living that fast life. So I think it's just important to note that queens come from all different walks of life. They can be in your ghetto and they can be at NASA.
You grew up in Kansas City, Kansas.
I did.
In a rough neighborhood.
Wyandotte County, Kansas. Yes, Quindaro. Mm-hmm.
Did you draw on your experiences there?
I did. I grew up on 21st in Quindaro. My grandmother had a home there. And when she moved there, it was a, you know, very decent neighborhood, but drugs did take a hold of that community. You know, there's still mom and pop stores there, but if you look around, there are a lot of people murdered around there, a lot of people selling drugs or strung out. And I was able to interview cousins and interview people who had to play that mother figure in the lives of so many young boys and girls because their parents, you know, got addicted to crack cocaine. That was that new drug. Mm-hmm. And there's some people that never bounce back. And so I had to do a lot of research, and I did have the opportunity to speak to very close family members and friends of family to understand what a surrogate mother, what those kids who had drug addicted parents, what they were looking for in a surrogate mom. And I think the common denominator was someone to just listen, not judge, someone to love them unconditionally.
How did you get that role? Because you were, you know, at that point, known for singing and mm-hmm. not acting. This is your first big screen role, I understand.
Yes, Moonlight was.
And how did you decide that you wanted to go in this direction in acting?
Well, a lot of people, I think, may not know this about me, but I did study acting. Fresh out of high school, I went to the American Musical and Dramatics Academy in New York City. And all throughout middle school and high school, pretty much over half my life, I bounced back and forth between music and theater. But also, I don't think people know this, I auditioned for Star Trek. They didn't have the name of the character, uh-huh. but it was for a role in Star Trek because I wanted my entry point in film to be in science fiction. And I didn't get the role. And the casting director on that film saw my tape, and she sent it to Barry, and Barry reached out to me.
Oh, wow.
So thank you, Star Trek, for helping me get Moonlight.
And you wanted to audition for Star Trek because you are fascinated with science fiction.
Obsessed.
Obsessed.
Obsessed with space, obsessed with the future, obsessed with sci-fi. A lot of that is very heavy in my music. You know, uh-huh. if you listen to it, my first EP was called Metropolis, mm-hmm. you know, based off Fritz Lang's 1927 German Expressionist film. He's like the godfather of sci-fi. Because he dealt with, you know, the android, the cyborg, and all those things early on. You know, I wanted to be a Black woman in the future.
So that you must love Octavia Butler, the writer.
I love Octavia Butler. Are you kidding me? I'm obsessed
with
her.
So why aren't her books movies that you can star in?
I would love to do that. If someone's listening, let's make that happen. I'm excited about where women can go. I'm going to say this because I didn't know if this was going to be a reality. But right now, I'm in a number one movie, Taraji and Octavia and myself. These are three African-American leading female protagonists, and we're number one. And I'm excited about women in film. No matter what our color is, just seeing women being celebrated for their minds and their brilliance and not objectified, but studied and looked at as subjects to study until the end of time, is so empowering, and it's so, I'm so hopeful. And so hopefully we can get stories like Octavia Butler's, you know, this African-American female science fiction writer off the ground. And I think this will open up more doors for us to tell these unique, untold, universal stories in unforgettable ways.
So when you look at science fiction and ideas of the future, do you see a dystopian or a utopian future?
I do think it's important to remind people that if we don't make the right choices, we can live in a dystopian future. Do I want to see that? Hell no. No, I want to see us moving forward and living in harmony. You know, this is a colorful world. And I think Pharrell says it best. He's a producer on Hidden Figures as well. I don't think this world is going to work without inclusion, acceptance, and love. We're so different, but we're so similar in so many ways. And we're just going to have to figure out how to celebrate our differences more and learn from each other. And empathy is also another word. It will not work without inclusion and empathy.
There's a big women's march planned for Washington during the inauguration of Donald Trump.
Yes.
What do you think of that?
I think it's necessary. I will be there. I will be in Washington, D.C.
At the march?
Absolutely. I think that is going to be up to the people, up to women, to remember that we hold the power. It's time to galvanize. It's not time to feel sorry for ourselves, to complain. It's time to do. These women in this movie, you know, Hidden Figures, they went through so much during that era. I mean, again, they didn't have the agency that we have right now. You know, we get to vote. We get to speak out. We get to speak against hate and sexism and racism and all those isms that constantly try to divide us. And I think we have to remember that we hold the power and we can't get up. We can't give up. We can't let up. No matter who's in the position of power, if you are abusing your power and you are trying to oppress women or minorities or those who are oftentimes marginalized, they should be held accountable and they shouldn't feel scared that they're going to be dealt with. And by dealt with, we are not going to stop marching. We're not going to stop voicing our opinions. We're not going to allow anyone to undo the amazing things that our president has done for women and for minorities, for the LGBTQ community, and those who oftentimes feel like they don't have a voice. We're not going to allow any person, not just those in the position of power, but other fellow Americans and human beings. We're not going to allow our country to go backwards. We cannot afford to do that.
Well, Janelle Monae, thanks for coming in. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me. And I really do appreciate KCRW supporting me for such a long time. Since the beginning of my music career, you guys have been allies. You guys have been big supporters. And I'm just thankful that I could come in and tell you thank you in person.
That's Janelle Monae, star of the new movies Hidden Figures and Moonlight. You can go to our blog to see photos of her here at KCRW, curious.kcrw.com. Go there, see those photos. She's wearing an amazing outfit. You got me with your attention. Coming up on this program, our new museums. They're built by rich guys, George Lucas, Eli Broad, the Guess Jeans founders. How they influence the art we see next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brandt. Rich guys building museums. That's really the story of museums since they were created as places for conquering leaders to store their plunder, consider the British Museum, as a way for industrialists to burnish their image as cultural connoisseurs, consider the Getty, the Frick, the Met. Well, now in LA, we have George Lucas's Museum of Narrative Art. The estimated $1 billion museum will house Lucas's personal collection of art and movie memorabilia. He'll join other modern-day wealthy men who have built or are about to build their own monuments to taste. Eli Broad, for example, of the Broad Museum, and the Guess Jeans founders are opening their own gallery later this year. Joining us to talk about this and what it means for the kind of art we experience is Julia Halperin. She's museums editor at the Art Newspaper. Welcome.
Thank you.
All right. So as I said, this has been around for a long time, but has it gotten more feverish in recent history as we're seeing a lot more wealth being created?
Very much so. In the last 10 or 15 years, there's been an explosion in private museums, both in the U.S. and across the world. According to a recent survey, the U.S. has 43 private contemporary art museums, which is the second most of any country in the world. And most of those were founded after 2000.
And the number one country?
South Korea.
South Korea. So who is doing this? Who are the people behind these private 43 private museums?
So they are mostly, I mean, they're all wealthy people.
Right.
They are mostly men, and they live mostly in cities, although some of them set up their museums conveniently near their homes in suburbs to those cities. And they're mostly collectors of, you know, big name, blue chip, shiny contemporary art.
And it's contemporary usually. Why?
Yes. Well, I think that's where most of the money in the market is going right now. It's also where the most sort of cultural cachet is located. And it means if you have a museum, you get access, you get better access to artists, you get better access to artwork, and it gives you sort of a position in a glamorous world.
Yeah, you get to go to art openings and fly all over the world looking at collections, things
yeah.
like that. So what's in it for the people who are doing this?
So there are a lot of reasons why you might want to put your money into a private museum. One is for tax purposes. It's a good estate planning move. You can deduct the value of the art in your museum from your taxes, as well as whatever it costs to store and take care of that work. Another big reason is control. Instead of donating your art to MoMA or LACMA, where it would in all likelihood sit in a basement for most of the time, you can keep it all out on the wall and visit it whenever you want and show it exactly the way you want it to be shown. And the last reason is cachet. You get the cachet of having a museum, which means that, you know, artists may be more eager to talk to you, dealers may be more willing to give you access to their best inventory, and you have sort of an elevated position in the art world.
And as I mentioned, many of them are opening up here in Los Angeles.
Yes.
Why is that?
Well, I think, you know, Los Angeles is, it's an art center, it's an art capital of the world, and it's only becoming more that way. And so I think it makes sense that collections that have been formed there over the last 10 or 15 years are now getting to the point where those collectors want to show them more publicly and make a real home for them. So the Broad is a great example of that.
And what about this new Lucas Museum? Is it in that same vein?
It is, although I think it's a bit of a different animal. You know, a lot of these museums, including the Broad and lots of museums in and outside New York, show sort of the same 15 or 20 artists. And they're all these, you know, big contemporary blue chip works. And the Lucas Museum is coming at it from quite a different angle. It houses, you know, his collection of mostly American artists and illustrations, people like Norman Rockwell and Robert Crumb, who you don't see in pretty much any of these other collections, as well as, you know, Star Wars memorabilia, which is definitely unique to him. And so it's a bit of a different, more populist approach than a lot of the other museums have taken.
Could this be a good thing, that in that if these wealthy people did not open up museums, they would just keep their collections to themselves in their private homes or their vaults or whatever? At least we get to see what they have, what they've bought.
I think that's sort of the debate. The question is whether they would, if they didn't open the museum, would they keep it in a vault forever, or would they give it to an established public museum like MoMA or the Getty? And so where you stand on museums, on private museums, sort of depends on your answer to that question. But a point that a lot of people who support these institutions make is that a lot of institutions that started as these private collection museums, like the Frick, like the Getty, after the founders die, open up and become real centers for much broader research and exhibitions and collecting.
Hmm. And could you see that happening with something like the Broad Museum?
Yeah, maybe. I think it depends on what your plan is for, if you have a plan for the long term. So the Broad, for example, and the Lucas Museum have big endowments that their founders have set up to make sure that they can last well into the future, leaving open the door for that kind of expansion. Whereas other museums, like, for example, the Rubel Collection in Miami, don't necessarily have a set-up endowment, a long-term plan. And so there's a lot of questions in people's minds about, you know, in 30 years, what are we going to do with all of these museums that haven't necessarily planned long-term for the future?
Right. So, but as you say, these museums often carry the same artists or the same kinds of works
mm-hmm.
by these superstar blue-chip artists. So in the short term, before possible expansion, what does that mean for our experience of contemporary art?
I think, you know, it means that we're getting a bit of a skewed idea sometimes of the importance of certain artists. If rich people favor Jeff Koons and collect him more than any other artist, if you're only going to a handful of museums and most of them are private, you might get an outsized idea of how important he is compared to every other interesting artist working today. And so there is a question about whether these sort of market favorites are going to have outsized importance to the regular museum goer now compared to sort of their historical weight.
And I imagine that the established museums, the LACMAs of the world, aren't terribly happy with this development because it means less art for them.
Right. I think, you know, maybe publicly they take a more optimistic approach of the more the merrier. If they go to Lucas one day, they'll come to us the next day because they'll get the museum bug. But I think privately there is a bit of grumbling that some of the work that's in this collection that they would want is now not going to come to them.
And also the fundraising, too, because if a rich person has spent all or a lot of his or her money on their own museum, maybe they're not as willing to give to an established museum.
Absolutely.
Julia Halperin, museums editor at the Art Newspaper, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Julie Myers joins us now with the listener feedback.
Your very own giant balloon animal here with the...
Are you referring to Jeff Koons, perchance?
Maybe. Also, in today's spectacles, we asked our listeners about the Trump press conference earlier today. Connor tweeted us that he was annoyed that the stupid BuzzFeed story about the dossier dominated the press conference when it should have been about election meddling. Monica Palacios says the Trump press conference was like watching a zany Coen Brothers movie. Lots of other thoughts on that on Twitter. Morgan Fahey wanted to weigh in on the Janelle Monáe interview. She says that listening to Janelle Monáe be excellent on KCRW's Press Play is so, so soothing compared to, well, you know.
Yes, we know. Thank you, Julie Myers. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. You know, I'll see you tomorrow.